coming up next on Lutheran Radio UK.
Worth doing badly.
Welcome to another Worth Doing Badly with me, Jamie Krieger, David Weber, and Ethan Stoppenhagen. On today's episode, we will survey the lessons for the fourth Sunday in Lent, according to Series C of the three-year series lectionary. And they are Isaiah 12, verses 1 to 6, Psalm 32, 2 Corinthians 5, verses 16 to 21, and the Gospel according to Luke, chapter 15, verses 1 to 3, and 11 to 32. We begin with Ethan Stoppenhagen.
David, the verse that sticks out to me today is when the prodigal son is in the pits, quite literally, and Luke tells us he was longing to be fed with the pods that the pigs ate, and no one gave him anything. And that's, you know, that's part of it that we take as a given in the narrative, right before he comes to himself. But this tells me that at this parable's foundation is a question. And that question is, what are you hungry for? What do you long for? What is your heart's desire? And I think you can ask this question of each character in the parable. You can ask it of the prodigal, you can ask it of the father, and you can ask it of the older son. And I hope that, you know, casting the parable in this light with this question, you know, gives us a slightly different perspective than maybe what we might normally hear. Because I think in many ways we reduce the parable to forgiveness, which is good, and it's at the heart of it, of course, that the father's unconditional forgiveness and his welcoming his son back. Is significant, but I think what we forget to see is what's behind that, and I think a lot is packed into that line, with the prodigal son, that no one gave him anything, so the part of being hungry is also recognizing where all good things come from, what things are given, and it starts to dipping into that givenness stuff like we sometimes fall into, but I think if we can keep ourselves on the right path, we'll be able to set off in the right direction.
Right. First of all, I want to say that I like your strategy, because the reduction of the parable to just the transaction of forgiveness, which is real, but it's not everything, is necessary. And the beauty of the lectionary is that we come to this very well-known story every 3 years, which allows us to actually build on it and go deeper into it. And so what I recognize is the Augustinian focus on desire, is a really, I think just it woke me up this morning, and we are recording this at an early hour in the morning, so keep on. How are you developing this?
We can take a look at each character, of course, and you start with the prodigal son, and he desires, and I think actually what all three characters desire is freedom. Freedom in one sense or another, and in some ways that freedom gets perverted. And we see that first and foremost in the prodigal son, who has the desire to be free to enjoy the material pleasures. He doesn't want to be under his father's thumb, and essentially wishes that he was dead, that, you know, give me the inheritance. And he wants to enjoy the cash, the fine food, the women, and the exotic travels. And those are all good things, things to be enjoyed, but they get corrupted when we don't recognize them as a gift. And all gifts are not meant to be, gifts aren't meant to be consumed, but enjoyed and respected and stewarded. Now, I like to think that there's ultimately an end to that consumeristic mindset. Either it's forced on us when the thing that we're consuming dries up, or it happens when we become disenchanted with it and seek other options. Yet even then, the longing is left unsatisfied, and we're left hungering for the pig slop. So there's always, desire is always there, waiting to be quenched, but I think primarily waiting to be directed. That's not normally how we think about desires, I figure. Do you think there's something to that?
When you enter, especially, you know, among the, our church bodies, when you talk about desire, it is immediately treated with suspicion. It is obviously desires are supposed to be rejected, and and we fail to recognize that only, you know, distorted desires are, that the whole creation began with the desire that God put in Adam and Eve, first to eat and then for the unity between them. So desire is at the heart and center of everything. And I really like that you say that we're not going to talk about it abstractly. We're going to talk about it in how it gets characterized in these characters. So I am really waiting for you to tell me, what does the Father desire? Because I have some questions about the Father.
And that's, you know, and we can jump there, because we get to the end of the, you could say, the first scene, and that line that has kept jumping out at me: no one gave him anything. And so he orchestrates this plan to go back to his father and work for him just so that he can have a little food. But he, the son, doesn't realize what the father's desire is. And
well, can I interject here?
Yeah, sure.
I mean, this strikes me as a very funny parable, that somehow disappointed desires make people stupid. So here's what the son said. I'm going to go back to my father and work for him because he was successful. Well, his father was successful because he knew how to hire. And the father would have had some questions. How are you with money personally? You know, how is your moral life? He is unhireable. And yet he imagines himself that I can go back on my terms, and that somehow I'm going to be received in this way. So the guy is delusional.
Yeah, and maybe that shifts the characterization of the father a little bit, and I'm sure your comments will feed into it. But it might sound like an oversimplification, but what I would say the father's desire is the desire to be the giver, and there's freedom in that. Like I said at the beginning, there's an aspect that all three characters are desiring freedom, and maybe we should say that the father desires to give freedom to his sons, not that they continually be under his thumb in a straitjacket, not that they ever were, but that freedom can exist given by the father within the bounds that he sets, and that proceeds from his compassion, and he's able to set aside his own pride and his reputation to hire back,
but he doesn't hire him.
Exactly.
No, he covers him in the clothing of a son.
Exactly.
He takes him. Yeah, I mean, there is no hiring going on.
And so there's a sense that the father is actually hurting his own reputation to welcome a son back like this, you know, to let the whole village, you know, see and hear at the party that the wild son is back, and, you know, the father has welcomed him back as if nothing has happened. But that's the sort of, that is the desire, that's the heart of the father to free the son from his own bondage to his own depravity, to really his own death, because he was as good as dead.
Just in talking, you've You started with desire, and then you've narrowed it down to two characterizations of desire in terms of freedom. Two radically, they both use the word freedom, father and son, but they are radically different, right? Mm-hmm. The son's freedom ends in dissipation. The father's freedom continues to give life. So I really like those two thoughts of connecting desire and freedom, I can say have never passed, past in my brain. So I really like this. Now, and then when you talk about the father's reputation, he's been destroying his reputation from the very beginning. The father makes the mistake of King Lear. Lear thought it'd be a good idea to disperse all his wealth to his daughters, and it ends disastrously. It's a very bad thing so the father is essentially King Lear, and but it ends differently, right? But would you give, God forbid, that any of your sons, if you have two sons, I'm sure you would want your sons to be like the older boy rather than the younger boy, right? So we would not choose the prodigal. we want the obedient son.
Right.
Yeah, right, but in this case, he doesn't get it. Would you, if you knew the character of that boy, would you give him the very stuff that he's going to choke on? And so that just gets my mind going. Yeah, freedom is an incredibly dangerous thing. When God gave Adam and Eve the freedom in the garden and us the freedom, it is inviting all sorts of potential destruction, but also the father thinks it's worth it to have a son that isn't there out of obligation or duty, but is there because he desires to be there. Oh, man, you could stop there, but we still have a third character even complicates it more.
And we could probably say he might be the most complicated of all of them, because like his brother, this older son, at least on the surface level, wants freedom as well. He wants to have fun and enjoy life, but he thought he could earn it by doing his time. And of course, he's very quick to remind his father how he slaved away for him to build up his household. So why didn't he free him? Why didn't he give him the fattened calf to go have a party with his friend? But the father rebukes him and says, "Child, you're always with me, and everything that I have is yours." So, and that's, you know, can we know? I mean, in the end, you know, we don't know what happened to the older son, right? He was angry, refused to go into the party, and the last words are the words of the father, that it's right for us to celebrate because your father was, or your brother was dead, and now he's alive, he's lost, and is found. And then the story goes silent. You don't actually know. You know where the prodigal is, you know where the father is, you don't know where the older brother is. And so I know a lot of people call this then the parable of the prodigal son, parable of the waiting father, parable of the angry older brother. But so, you know, what do we do with this? You know,
okay, I'm going to answer that quickly.
Okay, please.
You have an answer written. But we know from external sources that someone raised at the time of Jesus and before, any time a parable was started by a rabbi, their job was to own up to one of the characters, right? So their mind, that's how the intellect worked. That's how the logic worked at the time. They knew once Jesus started the parable, he would introduce various characters, and each person would say, "I'm that character in the story." So, if you're telling this, who do you want your congregational members to see themselves as? You've already introduced three of the characters, right?
Mm-hmm.
What do you desire? What's going to do your congregation most good if they see themselves as which of the characters?
Well, of course, the obedient older son, right?
Yeah, that is, of course, but I think most of the people see themselves as the father.
Ah, yeah, okay, yeah.
That, I mean, I'm that generous giver. I give, I give, I give. I get nothing in return.
Yeah, you know? Yes. That's, I see that now. Yep.
I think very few people see themselves as a son, and certainly in our congregations, which are, you know, well scrubbed and cared for people, we would never, the bad son would never be worshiping with us. I mean, at least that is my experience, and which is, I find sad. You know, yeah. Where is the church actually speaking to the person who is still eating pig pods or whatever the thing, eating pods yeah. with the pigs, you know? Yeah. All right. So that said, do you think if the people want you to say, have them think about themselves as surfacely righteous, but, you know, deeply corrupt? Not corrupt.
No, of course not. Yeah.
All right, so what happens if they start identifying themselves as the so-called good son whose goodness is only skin deep?
I guess they're left hanging, you know, I mean, they're left out of the party.
Or no, they what we call self-exclude.
Yes, they self-exclude, okay, yep.
All right, it's ominous. I mean, you really got me thinking here that, and I'm not convinced that maybe we're supposed to identify with all three at different stages, but but we certainly have to begin by saying we who are the good people sitting here are being spoken to in really serious sorts of things. And the pastor would have to be chief of sinners, right? I'm the surface person here that seems to have all goodness, you know, surrounding me, and which means that this is pointing the fingers at me. Any thoughts before you move on to the next text?
To wrap things up, and especially considering the older son, you know, and bring together this idea, you know, of freedom in the end, what Jesus seems to be saying is that freedom is found in the house. You know, the fact that in the house is where we are always with the Father, and everything that he has is ours. Now, it might seem...
Okay, can I just go in? Sorry, Ethan.
Yeah, no, please, go ahead. Yep.
No, that you just nailed it, because the bad son wants in and the good son doesn't. And it's in the house. That's where the freedom is. And he thinks he's in, but he doesn't really want to be there. That desire... I'm sad I'm not preaching anymore, because this would be very much fun.
Yeah, and I'm so glad to be. Hopefully, I don't forget any of this. You know, that's what tends to happen is that we talk about it, and I can't stand to listen to myself, so I don't go back and listen to it again.
Oh, so, yeah, I was going to say, if only someone was recording
if
this.
If only we were recording this. But yeah, exactly. I mean, freedom is in the house, and even the son, the older son, who thought he was in the house by putting himself basically in bondage to his father when he should have realized his father wanted to provide him freedom. You know, it might seem like even in the house, it might seem like it's constraining to be inside the walls. But the unending generosity of the Father ensures that we have everything we need, and not in the way that and it is that perfect freedom, right? Not where we serve, but we're not slaves. You know.
All right, move on now, Ethan.
Okay,
you're getting way too wordy.
in the psalm, in some ways, what was unspoken in the parable is made clear. Blessed is the one whose transgression is forgiven, whose sin is covered. The waiting father forgave the prodigal son's sin. And so you see God's givenness finds its fullness in his forgiveness. But you even get the picture of the son in the pits, you know, the psalm articulating the life of quote unquote freedom. Where it's nothing but silence, bones wasting away, groaning all day long, and then finally feeling the heavy hand of the Lord. So what is the solution to our own self-made freedom, which is just another form of bondage? recognizing the goodness of the heavy hand that leads to confession. I confess my sin, and I did not cover my iniquity.
Mm-hmm.
And only then can forgiveness pluck us out and stick us in a hiding place away from the trouble, sticks us back in the house, but it sets us on the narrow way. You know, again, if you were to see how this parable played out, you know, the prodigal son is in the house, but he is in a narrow way, and where we can still operate with freedom. And the idea is that we don't want to be like the horse or mule without bit and bridle, you know, that needs every movement dictated by our rider. Instead, mm-hmm. we want to grow in our understanding and freedom and in the knowledge of the Lord so that we can journey freely to his nearer presence.
Ethan, I like, as you are going to, I'm sure, move on to the Old Testament, I think our church has bowed too quickly to the world's definition of freedom. I just wonder where our confidence was in saying, like in the parable and in the psalm, you use the word freedom, but you don't know what you're talking about.
Mm-hmm.
A freedom that does that is just license is not really freedom. A freedom that ends in the pigsty is not really. And if anything can be said about Western civilization, it is an expanding pigsty. And all right. So how does Isaiah carry this whole thing that we have? The scriptures give us not only the word freedom, but what it actually means. And I tire, as we've said over and over, people who say I'm free in Christ to do what Christ commands me not to do is one of the ridiculous ironies of, you know, freedom of the gospel and how it's abused. And so I just love these passages and saying, no, we have confidence that if God gives us the word freedom, he is also going to develop it in which it's a real freedom and not just kind of fake license. All right, Isaiah.
All right. Isaiah, I like to, for this passage, is to back us up and remember that Isaiah is a prophecy. And what that means is that what he says is a present reality, but it's a present reality with a future manifestation. So everything he says is in the future tense. That doesn't take away that it's a real thing for us now, but it's still the full manifestation isn't going to happen until a future time. And so we are assured of our forgiveness and the true freedom that God grants it to us, but it doesn't mean we won't experience bondage in the meantime. That's such a hard thing to talk about. And to try to make sense of that the fullness of freedom isn't ours right now while we're still in the flesh. We're still going to experience fear and the fire of the Lord's anger even. But we have to see that as part of the bigger picture. And this might not be a very popular thing to say, but the givenness of God, I would argue, extends even to our experiences of pain and suffering, as they guide and direct us towards the freedom God desires for us. Because what Isaiah then reminds us too is that even in the midst of the fiery trials, we know that God is present as our strength and our song. And I think song is the key word there. We underestimate what singing praises to the Lord for all his glorious deeds can do to assuage our despair. Because we look back at the way God has acted in the past and how he has worked freedom for his people, and why would he not continue to do that into the future?
So much more to say, but 2 Corinthians seems to really wrap this whole beautiful symphony of texts together.
And I might need your help. But what I see here with Paul writing to the Corinthians is that this freedom, this forgiveness is lived in the body. If anyone is in Christ, he is a new creation. So the final gift of God is a new life in Christ, which isn't bound to the desires and lusts of the flesh, but is shaped by the desires of Christ, the desire for Christ himself.
Okay, I really like it, because what it does is it just clarifies things. We've talked about different kinds of freedom. Paul gives us the category. There is a freedom that is defined by the trajectory of the flesh, right? There's another freedom, which is the trajectory of new creation, which, as you said, it's a present reality, but really it changes the present reality by what's going to happen in the future. It makes the future, it gives much more credit to the future in its importance on our present. So I like that this text gives us these categories of fleshly freedom versus new creation freedom. And now now tell me the brilliant insight you have on that.
Well, I don't know if I'd say I have any brilliant insight other than that, it proceeds from the fact that Christ himself lived in the body of sin, right? It's all grounded in the incarnation. Even though, Christ lived in the body of sin, even though he himself had no sin. And, you have Paul's strong language that Christ became sin so that we might become the righteousness of God. And I'll be honest, I have no idea what exactly that means. I mean, it's as if Paul is saying that there is some kind of substantial change in who we are because of Christ's incarnation and redemption. And that, of course, is just a profound mystery that we'll never grasp.
But Paul seems infatuated with every detail of Christ's incarnation. It's almost like he every page of the gospel he turns, oh, so this is what it means that he who knew no sin became sin, right? And Paul is not saying, Jesus slogged his way through. Paul seems to say that Jesus lived brilliantly. Wouldn't it be something if we could even slightly participate in that brilliance? And which seems to me what the whole lectionary does in the slow move through three gospels. It's a fascination what life is when righteousness is real, and I like what you've done here is that it's not the freedom of the flesh which ends in dissipation. The real freedom ends in reconciliation. It brings things and people together. It's another word is integrity. And excellent. All right, wrap it up, Ethan.
Well, yeah, and that reconciliation becomes the final thing, and it's drawing us in, right? Christ on the cross is drawing all people to himself, and drawing us and leading us then into the house, right? The house of his body, where we dwell with him, and we dwell in all righteousness and in joy, and it is a feast, right? It is the feast which knows no end.
Thank you, David and Ethan, and thank you for listening. All the podcasts from this series, Worth Doing Badly, are available from our website, lutheranradio.co.uk. Try our app, download it for free from Google Play or the App Store. If you have any questions or comments about this or any other program on our schedule, send me an email to manager@lutheranradio.co.uk. I am your host, Jamie Krieger, and I will be back next week with David and Ethan. Thank you again for listening, and stay on for more here on Lutheran Radio UK.